I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The content of this week's show is pretty obvious to everybody. Out goes De Canio, in comes Ball for now. We'll discuss who may be coming in. And we have a win to talk about. That's right, a win. Gives the mighty Peterborough, but it's still a win's a win.
We had a win against MK Dons to talk about.
Exactly. Well, I know, but this one felt a little bit better. I'm joined by Gary Foster from the Shields Gazette, and I'm joined by Craig Clark from the Roker Report. Craig's sort of hogging this a little bit now. It's about the third time he's been on in about 6 weeks. But I know he was I know he was down at the Hawthorn, so I'd start with you straight away, Craig. I want to know what the body language was like at the Hawthorns. It's been getting progressively worse week by week. Did you notice anything even worse? Like, did you notice a deterioration again on Saturday?
I mean, in amongst the sort of dreadful performance, I don't think the body language was even that noticeable. I suppose, in a sense, they all just looked like defeated men. Mm-hmm. At the end of the game, a couple of players did sort of come over and try and applaud the support, which resulted in the kind of mixed reaction Di Canio got. There was a lot of booing, and I suppose it was warranted. Kieran Westwood in particular just seemed to start slumped in his goal. I don't know, it's hard to explain. They just looked beaten. Mm-hmm. They looked kind of finished.
5 games in, that's not a good place to be, Gareth.
Somebody said as well about Westwood is that Myhill came over to console him while De Canio was doing his whole thing, that keep your chin up and all that kind of thing. So that's pretty poor, really, when you look at it, and maybe it goes to highlight what went on in the dressing room afterwards, and then obviously at the training ground on Sunday morning.
Was this for you specifically, Gareth? Because, you know, we were just on a couple of weeks ago and we were talking, and you were saying that you were complaining and people complaining about De Canio, his methods, saying that, no, you know, like, no, well, I'm just, you know, you're making the point that somebody's come in and done a little bit different, and then people were saying, oh, you can't do that to footballers and stuff. But more than anybody, I think your attitude's turned around pretty quickly.
Well, I don't know if that's entirely fair, trying to stitch us up.
I'm not trying to stitch you up.
No, what was
it? That's there for all to
see. No, it is. Well, it's there for 10 people to listen to, and then 5 people to re-listen to it. So my opinion was that people do things differently in order to get results, and, you know, you try to do this thing differently to see if they got results. The irony was that what was going on in the dressing room and on the training pitch was clearly a hell of a lot worse than what he was saying in front of the television cameras.
Yep, I agree with
and
you.
And that's the worrying thing. Mm-hmm, saying it. That John O'Shea is silly for making a mistake and that Ji Dong Won bottled a header is entirely different to going in a dressing room and going, Lee Cattermole, your fault for the third goal. Having to go with Jack Arini, hoiking him off at half time without even giving him a chance to correct himself. I mean, what kind of manager, like, it's this half time substitution thing? And I've highlighted that before. I've always had a problem with a lot of football decisions, and that's another one of them, and that was again in evidence at the weekend. Let's take Jack Arini off at half time. Why? Like, why do you have to change it at half time every time? Give them a chance. You're telling me Jack Arini couldn't be better in the second half given the opportunity? Mm-hmm. Of course he can. He's an Italian international. He's won the league in Italy 2 years in a row, playing for Juventus, one of the biggest clubs in the world. He comes to Sunderland, it's like, oh, he didn't play that well the first half. Off you go.
Mm-hmm. Gareth's mentioned there about what's gone on behind the scenes. It's ironic in a way, isn't it? Because there's been this narrative that, you know, the players aren't happy with him, criticising him in public and the like. But like Gareth's just touched on now, I agree with him. I maintained at the time, and I still maintain now, that John O'Shea will not have been particularly bothered by his manager coming out and making everybody aware that he made a mistake. But it's obviously been some stuff going on big time behind the scenes. There's always stuff goes on behind the scenes with managers, but people were making out like that wasn't happening and he was doing it all in public, but it sounds like he was doing it in public and doing it behind closed doors as well.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of bad feeling in the change room and in the squad for a few weeks now. I think it's easy to come out and say now what the problem was. I mean, not a lot of people were saying what the problem was when De Canio was still there. I don't know if that's because they were frightened of upsetting him, where they were frightened of getting banned, but now that he's gone, everybody's sort of coming out and being an expert on ketchup gate, you know, and moving the kettles and, you know, all this, that and the other.
Locker's getting thrown across the room.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the last time I was lucky enough to be on here, I did say that it would all end in tears, and it has. I didn't expect it to be this quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, the story was always De Canio. You know, I heard somebody say on the radio today, I think it was Will Greenwood, the England Rugby International, and they were actually talking about De Canio, and he said the thing is, you know, the best way to do it is to be a manager, is that when everything's going wrong, you turn around and say, look, I'm the manager, I'll sort it out, it's down to me. When things are going great, it's when you should be passing it on to your players. Obviously, we didn't see that with De Canio because it wasn't going great this season. But that's when you should be coming out and saying, these are my lads, these are doing it for me. I know people are saying that these are highly paid individuals, and they are, and they lead a luxury lifestyle, but slagging somebody off, whatever their job is, week in, week out, is not going to get the lads up for it. You know what I mean? If you went to work every day and your boss told you weren't, you know, you were rubbish, and then he wants you to go out and do your job, and then when you come back and he tells you you're rubbish again, and then go out and do your job, it just doesn't motivate people. You know, you can only hit people with a stick so many times before the stick breaks. It's the carrot and the stick, isn't it? And there was no carrot; it was just stick, stick, stick.
I think a lot of it though still is down to winning games, because you know, I bet the Swindon players don't feel, you know, strongly against De Canio because they were winning games. The difference is, Craig, that he kept going on about how he lost 5 out of 6 games at Swindon first, and said by the time the players, you know, got around to my way of thinking, everything improved. And that might be true, but the Premier League's a bit unforgiving. You haven't really got time to manoeuvre in the Premier League, and if things aren't working, with respect to League 2 sides, League 1 sides, you know, it's more ruthless. You're not going to get away with it.
You've also got more opportunity to sort of change personnel at that level. I think when you look at clubs lower down, there's players coming in and out continuously, a lot of loan deals, a lot of one-year contracts. It's not like that in the Premier League. I can remember when he had his bit about Bardsley after the Spurs game, that started setting alarm bells ringing for me, because I thought at the time, and I did say it at the time, we don't need to hear this. We know he's done wrong, and you need to tell him that, but you don't need to tell us that he's done wrong, because we can say it ourselves. And yeah, it was only Phil Bardsley, but it's then since been other players who were actually players that we want to do well here. And you can't just say, right, well, we're going to get rid of all them and replace them, and then replace them. He had his 14 signings, regardless of how much input he had in which ones came in. That isn't the point. We don't have the budget, he doesn't have the time to then say, right, well, I don't really like Cabral out of that bunch. He kept, I don't know, seemingly didn't get on very well with Giaccarini either. I mean, you know, you can't just say, right, well, we're going to get rid of them and bring in another 3 or 4 players. There isn't the scope to do that.
He needed Swindon.
Yeah, we did that. I mean, that was one of the things that we were told about at Swindon, was the player transfers. It looked like the warning signs were there that might happen sort of every summer, and that is not part of whatever plan I think Ellis Short was looking to implement. So I think he would have been quite alarmed by that as much as the terrible results.
Yeah. Sonny, on the subject of sort of coming out and criticising people in the press, I think it's interesting that a lot of the players, including Giaccarini himself, who was apparently one of the main instigators in getting him removed, which is pretty surprising, Craig Gardner last week, all came out in the press in support of De Canio, and maybe they were kind of in a roundabout way saying, this is what you do, this is how you do it, you don't go out and we don't like it, so we're going to, you know.
Maybe they were just scared sentences to do anything else.
But apparently Cabral answers a phone on the bus and gets, you know, we put in the reserves.
I mean, the thing that surprised me with going back to Cabral is he bought this guy, or, you know, Defante bought this guy, or whoever. We signed this guy, and he's like a brick outhouse. And he did all right first game. And then all of a sudden, De Canio's coming out with, he's not strong enough to play in midfield. So he plays David Vaughan and Seb Lawson, who couldn't fight the weight of a wet paper bag. You know, it doesn't make sense, and not a lot of it did make sense. I think that was the biggest problem.
Did he take his eye off the ball in a way that this became like an obsession to him? The thing about turning the club, making the club professional, you know, rerouting everything, this revolution, that he's just, because when it comes down to the black and white of it all, and that's the work on the pitch, he was failing and he wasn't adapting to it. Like Craig just said, you've got a squad to adapt to. We could have told him 2 years ago he didn't have the players. If you're not going to play Lee Cattermole, he didn't have the midfielders to play a midfield pair. Has he almost let this obsessive behaviour interrupt his own sort of development in a way?
I think a lot of us, me included, and I think a lot of fans, bought into them, we're going to be ultra professional, these lads are going to be fitter than ever before, they're going to do this, they're not going to get it their own way, there's no player power, I'm the boss. Fair enough, if you're getting results, you can probably do that. But bearing in mind, you've got the likes, you know, you had Roy Keane come here, implemented stuff that he picked up at Manchester United, Steve Bruce to a certain extent. You've got John O'Shea, who's won all, and Wes Brown, who's won all. You can't tell me these lads and have never been professional and never had the hairdryer and never had a bullet and never been stopped from doing this, that, and the other. And the fact that he had to take it to the far end and make it all about how he was going to revolutionise everything, it's just a step too far, or several steps too far, I think.
Certainly too soon if you're going to do it.
But the irony of it is, in trying to create this ultra-professional football club, he's acted in an incredibly unprofessional manner.
That's the crux of it.
The way you go about it. And, you know, that almost could be, encapsulate Paolo Di Canio as the person he was.
I know some people are sort of getting the wrong end of the sticks here. It's only ketchup and they're getting paid God knows how much amount of money. Why can't they not just do without ketchup? But that's just the start. You know, you've got them supposedly taking the kettles out of the hotel room so they can't have a cup of tea because tea's bad for you. And you've got them supposedly stopping them from drinking Coca-Cola, and then he's got them doing urine and blood tests all the time so they can check what they're eating and what they're drinking. I mean, it's football. It's not a prison. You want them to go out there and express themselves, and I'm not saying that having a bit of ketchup on your chips is going to make you go out there and be a world beater, but rule after rule after rule after rule after rule, it stops being fun. I know it's the job, but it's got to be fun. You've got to go out there and enjoy it.
I think that's entirely the point. I think the benefits that you're going to get from removing the ketchup in a physical perspective are going to completely outweigh the negatives you're going to get from a psychological perspective when you start taking everything away from people, start telling people what they can and can't do, micromanaging their existence basically as a player. And, you know, it's that as a mental effect on you as a professional. You know, like you say, like John O'Shea, it must have been bad if John O'Shea stands up and wants to go and tell, you know, the board that you got to get rid of this guy, because, I mean, there's a top,
seems to highlight
that's
the
a
extreme,
top professional footballer who's played at the highest level his entire career. He's played in the Champions League, he's played in the World Cup, he's played for Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United, and this is a guy who's gone, listen, no more.
I think also what highlights the point is when Di Canio came in and when we started doing this fitness, O'Shea was one of the blokes that came out and said, we've got to buy into this, we've got to do it, we've got to buy into this. It's obviously gone too far for him to turn around and say, well, hang on a minute, no more.
If he'd kept it going into, I talked about this, I did an article on Salou Sunderland basically slagging him off in a way, really. But it wasn't calculated, it was entirely fair, irrational. The transitional period when he came out end of last season, before, no points in this many games. Me, 8 points in 7 games. Well done. So what are you going to do now? Or what I'm going to do is change everything to something that doesn't work and get you 1 point from 5 games.
Well, that's a good point, because I was thinking about this today, actually, thinking that when he first came in, he was kind of implying, you know, we beat Everton, we beat Newcastle, and then he was like, oh, my players were fantastic, they were great, they were like warriors out there. But then by the time the Spurs game, which Craig has mentioned, he was almost changing to say, right,
I've been soft.
Yeah, like I've been soft, I've adapted to them. Yeah. Now they're going to have to adapt to me individually. And it's almost as if that's something as, I mean, he already was, we talk about ego, but he already had this kind of ego. But if it was manageable, I was all for it. But like you just said there, something has obviously clicked now, why he's gone too far the other way. And what he was doing last season was working to an extent, and he's changed, he's gone too far.
Look at the games we had in those seven games as well. I mean, the Villa game, very disappointing. I mean, we weren't great at home to Southampton and Stoke, but at least we were organised. And then the other games, Chelsea, Newcastle, Everton and Tottenham, they're sort of games that we've got coming up, that those types of games, tough games. What he wants to do, and now he's been sacked and he's sitting at home, is get that press conference off YouTube and sit and watch it over and over again and then listen to himself. And, you know, he always talks about how he analyses games and analyses, you know, what the weaknesses in opposition are and all that. Look at your own weaknesses. You've said it yourself, 8 points in seven games. Why change it so drastically? Because you think you're going to get better results. And when you're not getting better results, why not think, oh, sorry, lads, I'll hold my hand up. Let's draw a line under it. And let's go back. And I bet the players would have had a lot of respect if he'd done something like that. But he would probably see it as a sign of weakness.
I think like results, that's the key point. I know it's only five games into the season, but like, as much as people might like the idea of these ultra rich footballers being disciplined and stuff, but there has to be some kind of result at the end of it. I don't want to see these highly paid professional footballers randomly disciplined and given all these strange rules for it not to work. Yeah. What benefit am I getting out of that as a supporter? What benefit are the players getting out of that? And what benefit is Paulo Di Canio getting out of that? It makes no sense.
That's the bottom line, Craig, because, you know, I mentioned before the Fulham game, I highlighted, in my opinion, how much that important that game was. And I think, you know, people said I was maybe like over-dramatising things a little bit. But for me, Gary, it's just, if you're going to come in and you're going to do this, and like you've just said there, John O'Shea said, OK, we're going to have to buy into this. But you need to win games, like Craig just said. And had we won that Fulham game, I think it would have just, you know, people would have been able to tolerate the double shifts, the strict dietary regime and everything. And
well, yeah, because if you're getting results, then it's working.
Yeah.
But the difference was that it wasn't working, but there was no change. I mean, I think a lot of us slagged Martin O'Neill off for not having any plan B. Now, Di Canio came out and said he had a plan A to Z, but it wasn't working. It was the same plan.
I'm still waiting to see plan A.
And the difference was, I think you could have accepted if they were playing a lot better and we just weren't getting the rub of the grain and they weren't getting that lucky break and they weren't getting that goal and it was nearly there. We were just, you know, just a little tweak here or there. It wasn't any different. You know, they weren't playing any better. The performances weren't any better than what we'd seen before. Di Canio, so the revolution obviously wasn't working. Do you know what I mean?
We were better last season under him than we were this season.
Yeah.
And that because he was like the organisation in the team. And he had, this season was just no organisation whatsoever in what he was trying to do.
Well, it's interesting now that people sort of, well, not everyone, but some people seem kind of quick to blame maybe the players rather than Di Canio. But I didn't really feel that happened when O'Neill got sacked, although the players must take a share of the blame there as well. And it's interesting because without this 14-man overhaul, O'Neill took probably an inferior group of players and had a much longer honeymoon period than Di Canio ever had. Two wins, two draws. That's a very short kick after a new manager comes in, I would say.
It's interesting what you're saying about people sort of blaming the players, because it's an interesting point. I've read a lot of people saying, you know, the players have now stopped playing for three managers, but me and Gareth were talking about this the other day. I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think O'Neill lost the dressing room. I don't think Steve Bruce lost the dressing room.
No, me neither.
I just think that was two managers who'd run out of ideas, Gary. Di Canio lost the dressing room.
Di Canio lost the dressing room. The biggest thing about Di Canio was that he set this up. He's come out to the fans and said, look what I've done to Bardsley. Mm-hmm. Look what I'm doing about getting them fit. Look what I'm doing about stopping them doing this, that and the other. These are all pampered. He set it up, you know. Fans bought into it. Like, you know, they see, you know, they go to work 7 days a week or 6 days a week and then spend the hard-earned coin following them all around the country to see abject performances. And the bloke's coming out and saying, right, no more. They might be getting 50 grand a week, but they're going to have to work with it. And it's music to a lot of fans' ears, you know, me included, when he said, I'm going to do Bardsley because that's an inferior way to behave and what have you. Everybody bought into that. I think a lot of fans bought into that, that sort of thing. He's not going to stand for any nonsense. It's about time somebody got hold of these players. But what if it's not working? Then it's not working. And it's, you know, people keep getting mixed up and saying, oh, you know, it's only a part of the ketchup. It's not that. It's the culmination of the thing. It's the way everything's sort of building up. And, it, you know, it's one thing after another, after another, after another. And finally, the players have just said, right, no more. And as soon as one or two players in the dressing room say no more, you're going to struggle to turn it around. But when there's that many saying,
and especially when you've got new players, because the new players aren't exactly, you know, they're not going to disagree with the players, the senior players who are already at the club.
It's nice to see, in a way, if something is going to come out of it and they acted in the way that they did, then, you know, that shows that there's some solidarity in the team.
I think
and that's a good thing. If Giaccarini stood up to him because he's had a pop of Catamol, or Larson or whoever, they've all stood up for each other because they've gone, that's, you know, having a pop at Giaccarini, you know, like having a pop at Catamol. I mean, how much Lee Catamol have felt in that situation when you're just coming back, you've just got your way back in the manager's plan, and yes, he's done stupid stuff in the past off the pitch, still a footballer, he's got himself back in there, and then he goes, your fault, third goal, what were you doing?
Ironically, of course, he came on and prompted our best attack of the game.
And then Fletcher got injured.
Had a really positive influence.
Yeah, and Fletcher got injured, and then we didn't have any substitutions left.
I think the players tried to highlight that point, or for me, tried to highlight that point on Tuesday night when the first goal went in. They all sort of ran together and celebrated together as if to sort of make the point of, he's gone now, we're all in this together, and we weren't before. You know, we weren't allowed to be. And I think they were trying to sort of illustrate the point in their own way by diving on each other and want to congratulate each other, trying to show fans and the press and whoever else that, you know, there is some unity in there in the dressing room.
And at the end of the game as well, they made a real point. A lot of the senior players, particularly like Larson, Corbett, Garner, Westwood, people who've been here a while, made a real point of applauding the fans. They went to every bit of the ground and applauded. And I think that was quite a nice moment. I thought, you know, yeah. I think you could see in the faces on Tuesday that, you know, at the end of the game, it was like a cloud had been lifted off the shoulders. You could see it, and in the game as well, they played with a lot of freedom, and it looked like people having fun playing football, and it was good to see.
And a big win, Craig, as well, because I was one of the people before the game who said, you know, right, you've got to go out and show me tonight then that it was down to the manager, because it would have been obvious to the players that this would have come out in the public, that they've went, you know, they've kind of revolted in a way. So they had to go out and express themselves. And even though Peterborough playing well, the two divisions below, so you should really make that a routine victory. And they did, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you contrast that with the MK Dons game, another team at that level. And although that was a arguably more exciting game, it was only more exciting because they were utterly dreadful for 70-75 minutes. Then, you know, Wickham comes
quick
on
fire,
and it changes.
Quick fire response.
But it was exactly what you expect from a game against the League One side. No matter how well they're playing, it was just professional. They went out, they played the game, and it resulted in a couple of decent goals. And that's what you want to see.
That's all we want, routine wins. It's only the fourth win we've got to speak about or something since we've been doing this.
I don't know where he was sitting or how busy it was where he was sitting, but everyone around me were all looking at each other and going, I've actually enjoyed it. Like,
Not so much next to me in the second half, strangely.
You're always going to get them.
But the first, you know, and it was nice that you could see people going, oh, that was nice to watch a good game of football. And it was, and it was, you know, like you say, controlled professional performance with a lot of quality in there. A lot of the players played. I don't think a player had a bad game, and I think Key in particular in the middle with Catamol could look like they could form a pretty good partnership. Similar players in some respects. I think a bit more craft. Key's got a bit more craft than Catamol, but Catamol can pass it around, and, you know, Key's got a bit of a nasty streak to him as well.
I think Key and Catamol is one we've wanted to see for a while. But how much of this was down to the Kevin Ball influence, Gary? Because I think mainly, you know, primarily it's just down to the fact that players feel, you know, De Canio's not there. They played with freedom. It's, you know, it wouldn't be logical, I think, Kevin Ball's come in and changed anything, particularly in two games. But I thought his team selection was important because it could have been, he could have been quite tempted to play Barini, for example, play 4-4-2, think this is Peterborough, you know, we'll beat them if we just put a strong team out. He's got one eye on Sunday because Barini can't play, surely.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, he hasn't had that much time working with the players, so it's difficult to say just how much of an influence he's been able to be in that short space of time. But he was the one that decided to play Jatterini in the hole. He was the one that saw that would work rather than playing him out wide. And I think he had one of his better games that we've seen him have in the Sunderland shirt. So.
Key decision that one, Gareth, wasn't it? Because you just spoke about Jatterini a lot there. Now, this is somebody who has been, you know, average really on the left, possibly down to the system, because to be fair, when he plays for Italy, he looks inside, he's got Perlo there, he looks ahead of him, he's got Balotelli there, he's got an international left back behind him. It's a bit different. So, you know, Kevin Ball's looked at it and thought, you know, this lad's a player, we aren't getting the best out of him, how can I utilise him to get the best out of him? And it's worked.
Yeah, but he did keep the inverted wingers. I mean, he played Larsson wide left. I thought in the first half, you know, Larsson was really, really working. He really wanted to prove a point, and I thought he did really well. And that's what you get from Larsson. And it you know, points back to De Canio again. You know, how could you leave somebody like, not even have Larsson in your squad against West Bromwich Albion and put Barr on the bench? Stuff like that. But, you know, he's a proper professional, Larsson, and whatever you think of him as a footballer, he'll always do a job, and played. He's played all sorts of different positions for Sunderland, and played left, did very well. You know, I think we all wanted to see some form of three in the middle, Stephen. And there we got a sort of version of that.
Well, I said Jatterini in the middle could be an option from the start. Whichever way you do it, it just depends whether you go the 4-3-3 or the 4-2-3-1. I don't mind either, to be honest.
I
don't
have the 4-2-3-1.
I don't have a preference. I just didn't want 4-4-2. Anything apart from that.
Well, I think Jatterini can play that kind of almost. In that game, he, against inferior opposition, he sort of had more of a free role. He roamed, but he seems to have like enough about him to maybe drop and make a three if that's what's required.
Yeah,
which is another useful thing to have
and
in the squad.
Johnson and Barini could play in that system up front as well. There's the two wider players coming in. I think
we'll speak to Neil. Well, we've already spoken to Neil, and you'll hear that later. But we did talk about Liverpool played against Manchester United. They played three at the back with sort of wing backs. Jatterini getting in those, roaming all over the place, getting in those spaces behind their wing backs. I think that's you know, something. I think he will get space. He finds space, doesn't he? You could see that, and he'll drop in and move about. And
then again, they do have Lucas in midfield, who is excellent at cutting the ball out, and he is a good ball winner. And if you've got three centre backs, maybe if that is happening, one of them just sticks with Jatterini just as a potential counter argument.
Let him, you know. And then you can drag him out.
But that's,
you know, you can drag him out, and then
that's
you can
useful,
get people in behind.
Absolutely.
We could have had a break in the fixture list, Gary, again, couldn't we? That hasn't fell for us this season. We're talking about it again, doesn't it? I mean, coming off the back of a Peterborough win. It's a winnable game, let's be honest. We are capable of beating Liverpool. But you would have just fancied something, you know, a mid table side perhaps, or would you think they're gonna rise? You know, they're going to rise to the occasion against somewhere like Liverpool.
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you've got to play these teams twice sometime in the league. You know, whenever you meet them, it's going to be a difficult game. But you know, Southampton managed to take points off them, so you know it is doable. They're playing a lot better.
It might help them keep them on the toes more anyway. Might not have ball. He's not going to let that. You know, not going to let motivation levels drop anywhere. But
he's not. But I mean, I'm not for 1 second saying that. I don't think Kevin Ball should get the job. I'm not saying he's my first choice either, but I think if it was a mid-table team and maybe we turned them over, then there would be this massive clamour for Bawley to get the job. Now, I think, you know, you've got to step aside from that and take a look at the wider picture and the longer game, as it were, and decide, because they can't make another mistake. You know, we all wanted Martin. I think, well, I'm presuming we all wanted Martin O'Neill. He was going to be the man. He was Sunderland through and through, and all that sort of thing. Didn't work. De Canio was the man for the revolution. Didn't work. So they've got to get it right this time, especially given that they've done this director of football thing. You've got to get the right man in, because if you might only be five games into the season, but you can't then go and sack another manager. Mm. You've got to give the new guy time. So how far into the season before you think, oh, this new guy's not working? They've got to get whoever they choose. It's got to be the right man this time.
Is Kevin Ball a serious contender, Craig, for the job?
I'd like to think he was, because he seems to have come on a lot. He knows how to set a team up. I think Tuesday night proved that. I don't watch a lot of the under-21s, if I'm honest, but from people who do, they said as much before that game and they were proved right. But you don't want a situation where we are sort of rock bottom for him to come in, and if that continues, you don't want to see someone who's so well loved at the club potentially put into a really difficult situation, and his reputation could in some ways be tarnished by it. I'm not saying it would, a lot of fans would empathise, but at the same time, like, look what happened with Shearer taking Newcastle down. Do we really want to see Kevin Ball put into that situation?
And the thing is, Gareth as well, he's a bit of an enigma, you know, in the management aspect, because like Craig just said, he's been in the under-21s, but it's a different ball game managing the first team level. Now, he might be great. None of us knows what goes on, you know. None of us know how he thinks about tactics. None of us have sat down and had a discussion with him. But like Gary said, we don't want to go back in the same, we don't want to end up in the same boat again. So give him the job, performances could lift. 15 games later, you start to think, oh, this guy doesn't know how to change things. It's too much of a risk, isn't it?
I think the main issue I'd have with Ball is that he hasn't really been involved with the first team.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that's what I'm saying.
The thing is, I could see Kevin Ball being a Sunderland manager in the future. The problem is, it's the pathway to getting there. And the longer he stays at the club without being involved consistently with the first team in some capacity, the harder it is going to be for him to come in as caretaker and then do well and then say, right, I've worked with the first team, the lads know us, there's a level of continuation in what you're doing, but he's got his own ideas and he can hopefully change and turn results around. A lot of people have been saying, well, he should be, like I think Gary Bennett said on Total Sport last night, I like the sentiment but I don't agree with it, is about bringing him in as number two to the new manager. It's never going to happen, because whoever comes in is going to want to bring their own staff. That's your problem there. It's not, trick them with somebody.
Yeah, you can't dictate to the new guy, can you? Whoever it is, you've got to give him the tools that he wants.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Ball. He's a great bloke, and he's got the club at heart. But the new guy, whoever he is, comes in, has got to be allowed everything he wants to do the job. So if it doesn't go, you can at least say to the guy, well, look, we gave you every opportunity. You can't have a guy coming in and saying, well, look, they made me work with him. Look, I couldn't bring this guy who I've worked with before, who knows me like the back of his hand, I haven't been allowed to bring him, so that's why we're not doing it and whatever. Whoever comes in has got to be given whatever he needs to do the job to the best of his ability.
I think there's an opportunity for him to get involved in some capacity with the first team. But
first team coach, and then you've got the connection between the club and its history and what have you, and the new guy coming in. And it probably makes it easier for the new guy to sort of bed in if you've got somebody who's there at ground level who can sort of run him through things and see.
It's probably helped his cause, the Canio's departure in a way then, because it's almost like what he's been doing at the club for the last 10 years has gone unnoticed a little bit. Mm. And maybe the fact that he's been put in charge and everybody's seen that, you know, he put a team out, he had them set up well, and it's kind of just reminded us a little bit about him, Craig, hasn't it? So I think everybody's now on the sort of same wavelength where we're saying, you know, get him involved in the first team more. You know, pass on what he's made for the youth team to somebody else. Make a step up now. Well, potential manager in the future.
I would agree with that, because I think in the past, obviously he stepped in at the end of when McCarthy got sacked, wasn't it? Yeah. And I think this is a different Kevin Ball to that one. I mean, he had no real chance then anyway.
He got 5 points with that team.
Exactly that. But I still think you can. I think now, like you say, there's so much time passed, and like you can't. He's gone unnoticed.
He's getting his badges and things.
And you think there's something there, but does he maybe need, for his own career, possibly to go and manage somewhere himself? Because although we're talking about continuity and things, and some of the biggest clubs do that, they usually have a philosophy, something that's there that's going to be continued. We don't have anything there to continue on from to begin with. Mm-hmm. So, and look what happened the last time we're sort of promoted from within, Ricky Sprazier. Mm-hmm. Ballie's probably nothing like that, but
he won a game, one of his first games, 4-1, didn't he?
Exactly,
4-1 and
4-0. And first team coach of Man United and everything. He had the credentials, the coaching credentials, didn't he? Yeah.
But I think with with Bo, maybe as well as an issue there is like maybe he just enjoys doing the under 21s. Maybe he likes that. I don't know.
I think he's come out and said he wants the job.
And in your way, but it's Kevin Bo.
Again, I think that this has probably helped him. That it's probably reignited something inside him because he was kind of a little bit coy about it at first. Before the Peterborough game, he was kind of implying he didn't want it and he wasn't interested in it. All of a sudden, one win. It's probably the closest feeling you get to being a player and going out and winning a game as a player in the Premier League. So, you know, this might, you know, help him go on and do something like that. And something we'd all like to see, I think.
Not so.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To do a Di Canio witch hunt, or it was just interesting what one of the points that Craig made there about there's no sort of set in stone sort of that we play right, you know, like say Barcelona and Arsenal, they play the same, it doesn't matter what age group they play. It's interesting that Ball came in and changed it around completely from what he's probably been told to be doing at under 21.
No, he played the same system as he plays in under 21, 4-2-3-1.
So, you know what I mean? So the managers are in, is letting him have a free reign with under 21. So, you know, why do these teams not, you know, like something Arsenal play from like probably under sevens to first team, Arsenal play the Arsenal way. Barcelona, and I'm not comparing something to Barcelona, but Barcelona have got this. Yeah. That was what we were supposedly aiming for with this revolution. Yeah,
definitely.
And we were supposed to be going to have this legacy where, and yet all this time, Ball's been allowed to coach the way he coaches under 20, which is completely different from the way guys are playing in the first.
So we all got faith in this system still, then the director of football and stuff, because it's easy to say. I mean, I have as well, but I think again a lot of people are sort of getting trigger happy with this and saying, well, things could have been different if Di Canio signed Huddleston, for example, because he really, really wanted him. He isn't signing his own player. He's going to come out and use that as an excuse, isn't he? I'll be amazed.
Well,
if he didn't.
That's a difficulty you've got, isn't it? Di Canio walks away and says, "These weren't my guys." You know, I know we all know that he's supposedly supposed to have the final say on that, but I think he made a big deal even before the wheels started to come off. He made a big deal of not getting Huddleston. Huddleston was his number one target, so to speak, and he didn't get him, and he made a bit of a fuss about it then. And I'm sure once the dust settles and he comes out and, as you say, about how great Paolo is and how he saved the world and what have you, that he'll be coming out and rewriting history again about, you know, these. I didn't want any of these players. They forced them on me. So
people have just got to keep their heads cracked then.
Well, with regards to Huddleston, I mean, are we any clearer as to why he didn't come? Maybe he didn't want to come to Sunderland. Who knows?
Reports, hasn't
exactly.
Maybe he spoke to one of the lads. I mean, he was the only English player we were after. Maybe he's gone, listen, don't bother.
Now it's all coming out. I mean, you know, there must be mates. Yeah. From different levels, you know. Maybe people know.
Well, he'll obviously support Danny Rose, won't he? Yeah.
Well, there you go.
What was interesting, another thing about Bawley was I was watching on Twitter when he first sort of took over, and the Watmore that they signed from Monteringham, his dad was just appeared on Twitter apparently and saying, "Oh, great, brilliant. The boys learned so much since joining Sunderland and working under Bawley. I'm over the moon for the club and what have you." So he's obviously well thought of, he's obviously doing a good job with the kids.
Director of football again. Maybe there's nothing wrong with the system. Do we know enough about Di Fante and what he represents? I saw Duncan Jenkins on Twitter was saying, if you're going to go down the director of football route, get someone with experience of doing it, because lest we forget, this man is basically an agent who's been converted because short trust.
Short like the idea of him being able to manipulate the market, I think, didn't he? You know, nowhere to go to look for cheap deals and all that stuff. And I haven't necessarily got a problem with that, because I think Angeloni's got a lot to do with the player recruitment as well.
Yeah.
But it's just a case of when something like this happens, it's automatic, I think, to start feeling a bit insecure about something. Yeah. And I think we just all need to keep, if we just keep our heads a bit, it's gonna be important the next guy understands his role.
I think he's an unknown quantity as well. I think we don't know a great deal about the guy. We don't know a lot about his background and whatever. We obviously know he's an agent, but his footballing background and whatever and whatever. But a cheap shot as it may be, I'd rather have our director of football ball than the one up the road.
Yeah.
He probably's applied for the job. Well, he probably wants to get back in the management.
Has anyone got better credentials than the man who won it all? I mean,
we're going to speak about.
Going back to Bally, sorry. I was curious about how, like you were saying, Gary didn't have much time with the first team squad. How is it that those players were moving off the ball so freely in 24 hours? This is the thing that baffles us sometimes about football and coaching. Is that just a mentality that you can instill into people where you just go out, you just go out and have fun rather than going, when the ball's here, you're there.
I think Di Canio's methods was so regimental.
I'm not just talking about Di Canio's because this movement off the ball thing.
We didn't exactly move off the ball, O'Neill. I think their strategies are so regimental.
Yeah, the trouble with Martin O'Neill was it relied so much on other teams having a go at Sunderland first and then Sunderland breaking. Which is great if you've got a team that's not very good that's coming at you and then you keep taking the ball off them and hitting them on the break. But if you allow the likes of Man United and Arsenal and that to keep having a go at you for 90 minutes and hope you're going to nip to the other end and get a one, you know, it's suicide football, really, isn't it? So I take what you mean about the movement off the ball.
It was great, wasn't it?
It's something that you think is so easy and seems so simple that to move it, the space, and to get it and give it and go, and there's so many players that don't do it, and not just at Sunderland.
I think being restricted by, almost to the point of where, I mean, Gareth and I spoke about this the other day, almost to the point where Di Canio was telling them what runs they can and can't make off the ball. That's where it seems. But we're going to speak about potential managers when we come back. We're just going to listen now to an early conversation Gareth and I had with Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Rap, and he gave us the Liverpool perspective of Sunday's game. We have Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Rap on the line. I suppose this game's a different proposition for you, Neil, than it perhaps was a week ago.
Yes and no. It very much feels now like one Liverpool need to win in order not to have a season sort of tail away before it's really got going. That's my concern, really. Having started the season brilliantly with those three wins early, things felt good. You know, it felt very, very lively. Went to Swansea, got a decent draw against decent opposition. But then it's, you know, Southampton are a decent side as well, but it's, you know, it does feel like 3 points dropped. In a season where it feels a bit like anything's possible, the league's a bit mad, in that it's already settled into quite a clear top 10.
Yeah.
But how that top 10 ends up at the moment, you know, no one's really impressed until Manchester City decimated Manchester United. So, yeah, you know, it does feel like a big game for us now.
What about from our perspective? Because I suppose, you know, a week ago, teams were probably looking at Sunderland and we were kind of like sitting ducks to everybody. But, you know, as with all clubs, when a manager leaves and a new one comes in, things get refreshed a little bit. So is that something that concerns you?
Very much so, not least because the talk of the fact that it's the players who've come out against the manager makes, you know, and you're aware of that as supporters and the nation's aware of that. And then they're playing on television on the, you know, on the Super Sunday game. They've got to stand up for themselves. They've got to really go in for everything. You know, it's a massive game for those players, those individuals. Now they've got nowhere to hide at this stage. So I think that is going to be play a factor as well. You know, I'm expecting to see a Sunderland side that's on it and focused for 90 minutes. And I think that Liverpool, you know, may well have to play better than before. You even look at the tactical aspect, they might have to play better than they would have to do 10 days ago or something like that. Because those players have now got to really show something.
Mm-hmm. And also from the perspective that if any work Liverpool have done on Sunderland this season, looking at Di Canio's systems and the like, that's all out the window now, and it's, you know, it's very much a bit ambiguous now going into the game.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you and I have spoken just earlier, Steve, and you've said to me that, you know, you play much more of a 4-2-3-1 midweek. You'd expect something similar again, 5 across the middle, and awareness to fight for everything. See if you can get a set piece against this Liverpool side that's a bit wobbly. rather than going at them, which is what I think the Canio side would have done, which would have left them open to what, to, you know, at the back end of last season, at least, was a very good Liverpool side on the counter. So I think, you know, it's concerning from a Liverpool perspective. I'm bullish enough to think that we'll get a win, but I just think we're going to have to work a hell of a lot harder for one.
Yeah. It's interesting, Gareth, isn't it, that, you know, we're sitting here ourselves, and even we've got a bit of an idea going off the Peterborough game the other night, but we don't exactly know what he's going to do ourselves, so it's kind of hard to predict what we're going to line up, what his strategy is going to be, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we'll probably see Solichka come back, and I don't know, there might be a couple more changes, maybe at centre-half. Obviously O'Shea's injured, so I don't know. Like you say, it's tough to guess. But I noticed that Liverpool lined up 3-5-2, was it, against Manchester United? Am I correct?
Yeah, it was 3-4-1-2. Moses was very much floating between midfield and attack. We actually played some of the best stuff we played all season. We just fell behind to a daft set piece goal immediately after half time. We were wobbly at times to a good transitional pass. United still haven't had that Ferguson knack of being very good at the pass before the pass that leads to the goal knocked out to them by Moyes. But give him a few more weeks and he'll manage that. But they were able to utilise that space against Liverpool in the early going that was, you know, with this new system. But as the game wore on in the first half, I thought Liverpool grew into it significantly, and with a better side going into the break. They conceded a daft goal, and then, you know, from there United just sort of sat back and tried to hit them on the counter. But, you know, interesting shape. We kept the ball a lot better than we've been keeping it in the early part of the season. The centre-half seemed more comfortable with the base three of them, certainly playing out from the back, and it just seemed to slightly coalesce into something a bit more significant than certainly that done against Southampton, when Liverpool looked very get-at-able by a side that got on their face.
Yeah. I guess that Brendan Rodgers will have been preparing the system for a while, because, you know, the length of time Suarez has been out, you're always going to include somebody like that back in your side when he's available. But obviously Liverpool were playing very well in his absence, weren't they? So it's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm not going to say he's had to shoehorn him in, but it's obviously something he's had to think about. I'm guessing he's had weeks on the training ground to practice it.
It's more than that, Steve. Last season we went to form. Second to last game of the season. For the first half, Liverpool played three at the back. And at half time, it was 1-1 at half time. And at half time, Andre Wisdom went off. And after the match, when he was asked about it, Brendan Rodgers said that was always the plan. We were having a look at three at the back in a game scenario, because we've been working on it in training. So this has been, you know, I think this has been in the works at Anfield at the very least since last April. So, you know, that we're playing it doesn't come as an enormous surprise to me. Now, that's not even to say that we're playing against Sunderland. I don't know what shape we'll line up with against Sunderland. But the very fact that we kept the ball better, I think, means that it wouldn't surprise me if he does go to Sunderland with an eye on three at the back. All that said, though, I mean, I still couldn't tell you, bar other than the spine of the side, exactly the personnel up there either. You know, I think it's quite an interesting football match, this, you know, in terms of discussing it from a preparation point of view, because there's no clear idea how Sunderland are going to line up. I'm not entirely convinced what Liverpool's 11 should be, nor what it is. And it's interesting that I don't know what it should be, and I don't know what it is. Normally, as a supporter, I certainly haven't watched this manager work now for over 12 months, and I haven't had three transfer windows. I don't have a bit of a first 11 in mind. But even now, not least because of the injuries, it's difficult to go, this will be the 11, or this should be the 11.
Again, we've just mentioned now then that it's a bit ambiguous all around in that respect, but You've already touched on the point that you see this as a harder game than it would have been maybe a week ago. That said, are you still going to come up looking for a win? Because how are your expectation levels now? Because Liverpool, you know, have dropped off a little bit recently, but the start they had of the season now, that must have people's eyes, like, that must have people now hoping for maybe a little bit better than originally expected. So you're going to be looking all out for a win, nothing less?
I think so. I think it's going to be another one of those games where the first goal is going to be crucial. I think that this league, this season, it looks more and more like that's going to be the case. The first goal is absolutely crucial. I think if Liverpool score it, I'd be very, very disappointed if they didn't go on to win the game. You know, I think that Liverpool have shown a gnarliness and a desire this season that was at times lacking last season. That's the one thing I'm expecting. I'm expecting to see, you know, a lot of seasoned heads on the pitch, a lot of sense from Liverpool if they go 1-0 up. It would disappoint me, as I say, to see them get to see that reverse. You know, in a sense, the biggest disappointment so far has been that they got 2-1 up at Swansea and didn't see it out. You know, despite the Southampton result, Liverpool were just very poor and were outplayed by a very good Southampton side. Whereas against Swansea, they got ahead. And that's what they've got to learn to do, is to hang on in those situations. And that's what it looked like they had learned to do earlier in the season. So, you know, certainly if Liverpool score first, I'd be very, very disappointed if it's anything but 3 points.
And you've just mentioned there that perhaps defending set pieces was a weakness. Is there any other areas you might be particularly worried about?
All season we've been really, and it's playing three at the back, nothing will change on this. We've been really, you know, if I was writing something on a scout manual, Liverpool have struggled with a decent switch. When we were playing four at the back, Henderson was tucking in on the right flank of midfield in order to do a lot of Lucas and Gerrard's running. So what was happening was, you know, we were open if you down the left for a good quick ball to get someone into a fair bit of space and maybe get 1-on-1 or 2-on-1 with our fullback. The other main issue that I'd be targeting if I was Sunderland would be that Liverpool have looked short of much fitness all season, certainly in centre midfield. Both Lucas and Gerrard have had alarming drop-offs after 60 minutes, and I mean alarming drop-offs in terms of energy after 60 minutes. Neither tends to be substituted than Lucas was the other night. Neither tends to get dragged off, for the main reason being they're both leaders on the pitch. So, you know, that's the thing I'd be looking at. If I was Sunderland, and having said what I've said about Liverpool hanging on, if it's 1-0 with 20 to go, with 30 to go, then, you know, Sunderland aren't out of the game by any stretch of the imagination. And the one thing that's come through with the Zaccagno scenario is that supposedly Sunderland's players look very fit indeed. So it wouldn't, you know, there could well be an upper hand.
Yeah, well, I think that was the idea. I'm not sure that was it was ever implemented like Decanio promised it would be, but we do have an array of central midfielders anyway ready to come in. Not the greatest of midfielders, but we do have options from the bench now.
Well, I'm interested now because especially if Liverpool do decide to go with their the 3-4-1-2 as they did against Manchester United, I think it'll be really interesting, because if we do go in with the 4-2-3-1, which we probably will, with sort of Larsson playing from the left, even though he's right-footed, and Johnson obviously down the right, they might get a lot of joy getting into those gaps that might appear in behind those sort of wing-backs, essentially. But, I mean, I'm a big advocate of three at the back. I was quite pleased to see Liverpool play three at the back the other night, because I think it's a bit of a...
A lost art.
Yeah, I think, you know, what is essentially a 3-4-3 for me is a really good formation, and it gives you lots of options defensively and going forward. So I think it could be a good battle at the weekend, especially if we do play the 4-2-3-1 with Catamol and Key spraying the ball about, because Catamol can spray the ball about, surprisingly. He is underrated in that sense. So I think it could be a really good game, especially how lively Jaccarini looked in the week. He just ran and ran and ran. He was like a little boy in the park, I thought, the way he played. He just looked like he enjoyed it so much. So I'm really interested to see if we can exploit those potential gaps and behind those wing backs if you do play in the 3-4-1-2 again.
Is there anything that's frightening you there, Neil, or we're just kidding ourselves here?
No, I think there's a lot. There's obviously stuff to be concerned about. Sometimes I've got a bad squad of players, I don't think by any stretch of the imagination. They've made interesting signings, getting them to gel. It's also, you know, I think to be fair to Decanio, a difficult sentence, but one I'm going to go with. I think that there's some managers who go into football clubs and they try to do what they want to do, and that's the high road, I think. And it can often, you know, go badly wrong. Last season under Rodgers, first 5 games, we only had 1 or 2 points. I think we only had 2 points after 5 games. We had some difficult fixtures, but it was because he was trying to play a very specific way, and then he sort of decided he had to play a way that just simply, you know, well, not simply, but that got the job done on a more regular basis. And I think that for managers, I think it takes a while to, if you're going to try and be attacking, if you're going to try and be aggressive, if you want to run a football match and you go into a club that's used to doing the opposite, then I think it's, you know, it's difficult to set that sort of stuff up. So it doesn't surprise me that someone started as badly as they have done if you're trying to change things significantly. The opposite of that, though, is that now the players. So I think that, you know, something can get at Liverpool. They have to be gone at this season, I think. The opposite of that, though, is that at some point I do expect Liverpool to click double forwards as they did at the back end of last season. And if Liverpool can get one or two up, then it wouldn't surprise me anywhere they go this season, within reason, for them to quickly make it 3 or 4. Certainly not a Suarez back.
Mm-hmm. I think the point you made there about Rodgers changing things and then adapting is interesting, because that's what Di Canio failed to do, Gareth, wasn't it?
He refused.
He had something in his head. It's gonna go this way. It's gonna work. And it was getting to a point. I think West Brom was a final straw for a lot of fans already. As stupid as that sounds, 5 games into the season, that, you know, basically that this wasn't going to work. And if he was going to be stubborn, it was almost like Martin O'Neill all over again, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it'd be fair to say that Martin O'Neill was more flexible than Paulo Di Canio, though.
Oh, God. There's an indictment.
He was, though, wasn't he? Mm. And you know, we'll talk about Di Canio on the show, obviously, tonight. But, you know, if Di Canio was in charge, he'd be going 4-4-2 or 4-2-4, as he likes to call it. He'd probably play Giaccherini on the left-hand side, which hasn't really worked. He'd just do the same thing, and his changes are never to change the game. His changes were always to correct his poor team selection that he made at the start of the game. But he wouldn't change the formation; he'd just change the personnel. I'd be more worried if Di Canio was in charge for Sunday's game than I am now with Ball in charge. I think interestingly, I've sort of noticed Liverpool have seemed a little bit goal shy, actually. They haven't scored too many this season, have they?
We're all about the second goal. We need to get a second goal. We need to go 2 goals ahead, I think. Last season, we were excellent on the counter. This season, nowhere near as much. And we're missing Coutinho as well, who does a fair amount for us. It's interesting. I think that there's been a... Liverpool should have scored 2 or 3 against Stoke. They probably deserved to go in on the balance and play 2-0 up at half time against Aston Villa. But against Stoke at about 75, they dropped in. Against Aston Villa on about 50, they dropped in. Same period of time against Manchester United, having gone in 1-0 up. And then they didn't really know what to do against Swansea. They didn't really make a decision as to whether or not they were sitting or they were going once they got 2-1 up in that second half, and Swansea played very well. So there's not been the same sort of fluency in front of goal that we sort of expected at the back end of by the time last season finished. I mean, Liverpool scored a ludicrous number of goals in the second half of last season. They scored 43 goals in the last 19 games, which is, you know, quite the return. This season, it's not like that at all yet. But I do think that's a matter of yet. Suarez looked interesting against Manchester United. I suspect he may well, with that game under his belt, he might look sharper again. I'm hopeful to see something from him in Sturridge. I'd expect Liverpool to score 2 goals against Sunderland. The question is, therefore, how many Sunderland get?
Mm-hmm. Luis Suarez likes going against us anyway, so we've got that to look forward to. So before I let you go, can I get a prediction from you, Neil?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with an optimistic Sunderland 1-3.
Right. Okay.
It's familiar. Conceding 3 goals.
Yeah, okay. Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap, thank you for your time, Neil.
Thanks, lads. Thanks.
Cheers.
With his perspective there for the Sunderland game. If you want to go and listen to the Anfield Wrap, I returned the favour and went on. So if you want to hear me talk gibberish, go and check that out.
What minute are you on?
Sorry?
What minute will you be on the programme?
I don't know, I didn't see it. Part 2. No, start part of part 2, I think.
Listen to part 1 of the Anfield Wrap.
Yeah, it's a little more professionally run than this. We are going to get back to the Liverpool game because we're going to finish with predictions like always. But like as I've just said there before we listen to that, I want to know what people... If anybody has a strong opinion on the incoming manager, we've established the Kevin Ball side of things. Has anybody got a particular manager they have in mind now? I'd say a lot of blank faces.
I know I don't want.
Right. And that is?
Who's going
to
get it?
Well, they were both mentioned early doors, but thankfully it seems to be a bit of a wide steer. Tony Pulis and Steve McLaren. You know, I'd rather go and watch something at Thompson Park. You know, just...
Tony Pulis was never a starter for me. No. But we're talking about somebody who's got to come in as a head coach. He's pretty much old school manager where he likes to run things from top to bottom. I just couldn't see that working at all.
McLaren, though.
He likes to play from top to bottom to top. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I think. I don't think McLaren will be even on the shortlist, but he's a man who has worked in Europe. So he's got experience, he worked
his way up through Courtland, didn't he? He was another one. He had Derby playing good football. He
speaks
Manu playing
loads
football.
Of languages as well, doesn't he?
not intentionally, obvious, but
he's macking one with people.
For me sins, having covered Middlesbrough for three seasons when Steve McLaren took over, thanks but no thanks.
No.
So what was the issues at Middlesbrough then that made you think that?
Just, I think everybody said that he was a very good coach, and the guy probably is, but he was a very, very lucky manager. Some of the stuff that, you know, they were getting away with was results, and you thought they were absolutely battered in that game, and then he had his sort of his number two, his head honcho, who was a sports psychiatrist who had them coming out speaking the same nonsense after every game. And I remember watching one game down at Fulham, and they got absolutely battered by Fulham, but 1-1-0. I mean, Fulham just like should have won about 7-1. And then I interviewed McLaren after the game. I interviewed Southgate, and we played it back, and it was virtually word for word. Bill had obviously coached them well in the and Bill Bezic had obviously coached them well in the changing rooms before they come out, because it was literally just like playing the same interview back to back.
So it's a no minute to McLaren then, isn't it?
Certainly not for me.
Emphatically said.
I wasn't being too serious.
But Craig, you I can't remember the names now on when we were all asked to do something for Rook Report. You mentioned a couple of random names. I can't remember who they were. Who were they?
I was sort of making a point by selecting random names in a way, because the point I was trying to make is not necessarily these three. I don't know enough about their characters and how they would work with this group. The point is, though, there's a world of managers out there. It doesn't have to be the same old Premier League, in inverted commas, experience. You can take a chance. Swansea did with Laudrup. I can remember myself thinking, I don't think this is going to work for them. How wrong was I? Pochettino at Southampton, how many of us knew who he was, and how many of us expected him to do quite so well as he has done?
It's a feeling of security almost, Gareth, isn't it? Because, you know, initially you think, okay, right, we're bottom of the league. And sometimes I think you instinctively think somebody with Premier League experience would steady the ship, and someone like McLaren or Pulis probably would keep us up. But, you know, if we're going to think long term,
exactly,
if we're
going to
think long term,
make your eyes bleed watching it, though.
a lot of these people again who
jobs for the boys
right. I'm going to do a little mini rant now. So all the people who've come out now and gone, oh, I told you so about Di Canio, all the people with no interest in football clubs, in Sunderland Football Club whatsoever, from the national media, who've got, you know, their summary of Sunderland written on a fag packet in the changing rooms before they go on and do the Soccer Saturday or whatever, right? And that's a fact. They don't know anything about Sunderland, they don't know anything what's going on, and you can see that. Then they all come out and decide that Di Canio's the worst manager, it's going to be horrific, and it turned out he was. But it's not for the reasons that they thought, it's because they were guessing, because they had no information whatsoever. And now they're all coming out and saying, oh, you need to go safe. You could do worse than Pulis. Where do you go from there? He's gonna drop off. Though that's what's gonna happen is we get one of these safe managers and then they come in and then do okay. And then
you're back to
and then you're back to square one because the results are gonna drop off eventually and there's pressure's gonna be on and you haven't. This revolution thing that people are talking about, he's another, all these Di Canio miss. Well, Di Canio set this director of football system up. No, he didn't. The director of football system was going to be in place before Di Canio got there, and Di Canio was part of it. Di Canio is not the revolution.
Yeah, and by the way, who's probably the other way around, it's probably Defante who sort of mentioned Di Canio to Short rather than Di Canio to see.
And this is the interesting thing about the director of football position, because he's not going to be the direct. If we're going to have a director of football, it's not going to be him all the time. He's going to leave or he's going to get sacked. And that's what happens, because it's a job. And you look at it now, he's made a bad decision in pushing for Di Canio, and now he's pushing for Poirier, and they're not listening to him.
Short's having second thoughts. Short is having second thoughts.
The thing with Poirier is that I think they're a little bit disappointed that he's gone so public and he's got his people to sort of leak little bits out here and there, you know, that they were interested and they were speaking
about
there
keeping things in house. It's not the best start, is it?
Well, exactly. I think Poirier is absolutely desperate for the job, and he's got these guys that are around him that are leaking little bits out here and there to sort of get the drum roll going and sort of get the momentum going and the push for Poirier sort of thing. But he's not too dissimilar. He does play. His side did play a decent football at Brighton, but he's not too dissimilar to Paolo for me in terms of temperament.
He's a much watered down version, though. He sits in the studio and has an intelligent conversation. Could you have seen the Canio sitting in the Match of the Day studio and having an intelligent conversation?
The point of crazy.
Can you see anybody sitting in the Match of the Day studio and having an intelligent conversation?
Fair point.
But the point that Craig made about sort of throwing names out there, but, you know, the Laudrups, the Pochettinos, and what have you, and everybody keeps saying, they want to go English, they want to go safe, they want to go English, because people who know the Premier League and that and what have you. By the same token, if they do go abroad and get a Pochettino or whatever, these fellas are more than likely to have worked with a director of football, so they are going to have more experience. There's not many English candidates or people from the English game who are going to have worked with a director of football and knows how that goes.
That's one of my main top of the list requirements, is that they know how the system works, they've been successful working within the system, and they're comfortable in it.
That's more important than Premier League experience.
It's so important, that is, to me. And I haven't got a name, but like Craig demonstrated in his article, it doesn't take long to find some.
I'd be tempted to do research and go abroad.
And if Tefanti can find Mavrias, and he can find Cabral, and he can find Moberg, Carlson and Barr, who is playing in the second division in France, he can find a manager who isn't Poirier or McLaren or whatever.
Do you just sense that because Poirier wasn't one of the Premier League all-time stars, he wouldn't even be getting considered now?
Well, Gary was saying, his team at Brighton did play.
But if he was called Bob, Smith, for example,
With Di Canio, because there was still quite a lot of sort of love for him, after he sacked him. But if he was just Bob Smith, who would have cared that this League One manager had been sacked from a Premier League club? And I do think you've got a point there about Poirier. His Brighton team, they were quite slow paced, and I was looking through some quotes about him and things he'd said, and in 2011 he wasn't having a great time in the Championship with Brighton, and he said, if they don't like the tactics, they can sack me. If these players can't do it, you can get me some new players, but I'm not going to change. And I just thought, that sounds very similar to the certain manager we've had very recently.
Their Brighton's record as well, didn't they have a if once they'd gone behind, I don't think they. I think something ridiculous, like you only won one game, one they'd gone behind under Poirier, something stupid like that.
Two of the points on Poirier, he actually worked and liked Dennis Wise, so that's a negative point in my book. And another one that he's got, he'd probably want to bring that there, Mauricio Tirico is his number two. And he was just a little cheat when he played, so I don't want him anywhere near my club.
It's funny, there was a quote that said something like, Poirier was like, all the games played were one football, so use it. It's like, well, what about when we were on the break against Leeds at home that time and he kicked another one on the pitch?
Yeah.
I actually remember Graham Anderson done a piece after that saying how the difference between Poirier and Keane, because Keane managed to sort of like level himself and adapt to the environment, where Poirier would never make it as a manager, so it would be a bit ironic now. I'll remind Graham about that when I see him.
If Gus does get the job, don't show him that piece of Graham's work.
I'm going to dig it out. We are going to have to wrap things up because time's beat us again. But predictions from people for Sunday. Gareth, you've looked at me, so I'll start with you.
I'm going to say a narrow defeat, unfortunately. I'm not going to give a score, but I think we'll probably get beaten because Liverpool are better than us. But I like, if we play with the fluidity was on Tuesday, we have got a chance. And now I'd love it for Kevin if we won, you know, he'd be absolutely delighted, wouldn't he? And we all would. He would. He'd be, you know, because it means so much to him, and he'd be full of pride, you know. So
Craig,
why not a draw? 1-1. They're not scoring a lot, but they're not conceding a lot. Mm-hmm. We've not really done anything, obviously, but you know, that's coming to an end. I don't know, just that kick you get from having a new man in charge, the release. I noticed he used quite a lot of the sort of older players, like from previous regimes, if you like. But, you know, there's still Premier League quality there. If he goes with that again, with the additions of like Key and Altidore, I think we can get a point out of the game.
Gary?
Well, my heart says 1-0, but I'm not gonna go with my heart. Unfortunately, I'm gonna see a 2-1 defeat. I think Sturridge, and I think the biter is gonna cause us problems at the back. So Well, they've got the cheat up front. He's a great player, but he is a cheat. So, well, they've got him up front.
They're
always going to cause us problems.
His league return against us, isn't it? These things always happen to us. But my heart says 1-0 as well. We'll go grind a win out. But I think one's each. I think one's each is okay. I do think the players are going to add an extra step to the extra dimension of the game. Let's see, extra spring in the step.
Well, they had it on Tuesday, so let's hope he continues that on. And if he wins, fingers crossed. If they haven't made that decision and he does win on Sunday, he's got every right to go knock on the door.
He's made it a lot more difficult for them. If they get a result and a performance out of them on Sunday,
be almost inclined to let him get on with it until he loses his first game and then bring somebody in, wouldn't you? But
Poyer's put him in a position and put himself in a position now where he's kind of putting the Sunderland board under pressure to make a decision, which can't be good in his favour.
Yeah, but that's the good thing, isn't it? If Ball does get a performance out of them on Sunday, gives the board a little more time, doesn't it? Yeah.
More
they don't have to act. They can go out and do due diligence and get whoever they want.
Give them up the Newcastle game, because if you beat Newcastle, it gives you apparently 11 games leeway.
And
you become a legend.
I can't believe you sacked him, you beat Newcastle.
Yeah, he didn't beat anyone else.
He is hoping anyway. And if we don't get through the Liverpool game with a win, we've got an easier game next week, Man United at home.
I like the way we're focused on Peterborough and not West Brom.
That was one of the best things. People didn't have to hear me talk about three-man midfields, and we didn't have to go over the West Brom thing. But I'd like to thank everybody for listening anyway. We'll be back next week. Over and out.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.